Okay. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, as I was saying. And is there anyone here from the medical community? Sort of? Okay, as I told Siv, I've given this talk to mathematicians before, and it was a great thrill for me to think there could be some medical people in the audience who but, I know, they're even busier than we are. So maybe they'll show up. So this is the title, and this work, it's been ongoing for 10 years or more, and I want to credit two graduate students who did a lot of the computational work, Julie Atamanek, who's now a high school teacher, head of the, she teaches math and biology in Cambridge, and Fang Dong, who's gone back to China, where she works for Intel in Dalian. So this generally is what we're talking about today, the cardiovascular system. My red dot doesn't show very well, so I think I have to be ambidextrous here. There. So we all know what this represents. Here's the heart and the lungs. The heart receives oxygenated blood from the lungs. That's in red. The left heart then pumps it through the body. The capillaries here in the body yield oxygen to the muscles and organs and so on and pick up carbon dioxide. The venous system returns that in blue, indicating blue, to the right heart, which then pumps it back to the lungs to be refreshed. So it's a closed system and fairly easy to model. Now, what is Cheyne-Stokes respiration? Well, it has to do with breathing. There it is. It's a periodic breathing pattern, okay? It's rhythmic breathing pattern, not the breaths themselves, which of course are periodic at rest, but it consists of intervals of no breathing, apnea, followed by intervals of very heavy breathing, oscillating back and forth, with a period of less than a minute, typically. At the same time as this breathing switches on and off, then the carbon dioxide and oxygen levels in the blood will fluctuate. When you're breathing, you know, you'll get more oxygen and less when you're not. So they have the same rhythm, same period. And this whole phenomenon is believed to be neurological in origin, and it's not to be confused, as I did at first, with what's called obstructive sleep apnea. This is during sleep, people often stop breathing for a short period of time and then wake or begin breathing with much gasping, usually not awaking, but awaking their partner if there is one nearby. This is due to just the physical obstruction of the nasal passages and the throat. Typically, as you get older and flabbier and relax, it blocks, and then you have to kind of wheeze to get it going again. So that's a purely physical phenomenon and is not what I'm talking about today, just in case you're wondering. I was confused because I'm one of those who disturb their wives this way, and I thought I had CSR, but turns out this is something else, but much more interesting. The other is not very interesting from a research point of view. So this slide is taken from a standard medical textbook. This is a description you can find in most standard textbooks. The upper trace represents the breathing pattern that I just described. Apnea means no breathing, it's flat, and then you get this rapid up and down inhale-exhale pattern of breathing, and the depth of respiration increases and decreases back to zero again. So that's what's observed without any medical equipment. The traces below represent PCO2 is partial pressure of carbon dioxide, okay, in the blood, in the lungs. Notice as you enter the rapid breathing phase, that falls because, of course, you're getting rid of carbon dioxide, so that's to be expected. When you hit the end of the breathing period and enter apnea, it rises again because your body continues to produce carbon dioxide and you're not expelling it, so PCO2 of the blood in the lungs fluctuates like that, rising during apnea, falling during hyperpnea, as it's called. Meanwhile, if you go to the PCO2, the partial pressure carbon dioxide, in the brain, where the respiratory neurons are, there are neurons that can actually measure carbon dioxide concentration in the blood, there is a phase shift, a time lag, which is due to the fact that it takes some time from the blood to get from the lungs to the brain, right? Because it has to be transported. There's a transport time. And notice that this concentration of CO2 in the blood near the brain is in phase, exactly. It's maximum when the breathing is maximum, minimum when the breathing is minimum. The phase shift, so this is, and you might wonder if that's a coincidence or is that something fundamental, that these are in phase, but these are shifted. So that's just a description of the phenomenon of Chain-Stokes respiration. What can cause it? A variety of factors can lead to increased probability, at least, of CSR, Chain-Stokes respiration. Low carbon dioxide. It can be induced by hyperventilation. If you breathe too heavily, you expel too much carbon dioxide. It sort of drains the, pumps the carbon dioxide out of the blood and lowers your CO2 levels. Or high altitudes have a similar effect. Sleep, aside from the obstructive sleep apnea I mentioned earlier, central sleep apnea is another possibility, central meaning controlled by the brain. Cardiac diseases can lead to increased probability of CSR. Congestive heart failure is a general term for the heart diseases that are associated with CSR that I'll talk about in more detail later. And another disease, encephalitis, which is swelling in the brain, can lead to CSR. So there are many things that increase the likelihood of Chain-Stokes respiration. Another important factor that goes back to an experiment half a century ago by the same Guyton who authored the textbook I mentioned, he did experiments in a dog by inserting just a tube between the artery, the blood leaving the lungs into the brain, so that, like playing a trombone, he could increase or decrease the length of the passage, this blood flow. And he found as he increased the circulatory time delay, he could inevitably produce Chain-Stokes respiration. With a long enough time delay, this occurred. So many people jumped on that and saying it's caused by time delay, and you know there's the Canadian applied math community, there's a number of people who work with time delays, and this is an important example of time delays leading to oscillations. However, if you look at the numbers, the time delay that was required in these experiments to cause CSR was much greater than is physically possible in the human, right? He had to add this long tube, which doesn't exist inside the dog. So there must be other things as well. This is a partial answer, but not the complete answer. Everyone here, I'm sure, know who these people are, Mackey and Glass, two very famous Canadian math medicine researchers, before there was even such a term. They have a delay equation model inspired by the experiment I just mentioned. Just very simple. Sorry. Very simple delay differential equation. X is the concentration of CO2, and X sub tau is the time delay, where tau represents the delay, the time delayed term. So this is has become a classic equation in the literature of differential delay equations. And they found if you increase the delay tau and increase mu, which is mu is defined to be n over 4, where n is the exponent in this nonlinear function here. This function is the Hill function that I'll say more about in a moment. If you increase this exponent, which makes this more nonlinear, or increase the time delay to beyond that value, then you get an oscillation, which they interpreted as Chain-Stokes respiration. That was an early dynamical systems analysis of the onset of Chain-Stokes respiration. Here's the Hill function, as I just mentioned. So it has this form where I've scaled this constant to be 1. As you increase n, it gets steeper. It has this S shape. So I use S there. For n equals 5, it's the dotted line. N equals 10, this line, and larger values n, it becomes more and more like a step function. It approaches a step function as n goes to infinity. And as I said, the slope here is called the gain, and the formula for that slope, just take the derivative, it's n over 4. Okay, now, so that's background. Now I want to talk about the mathematical model that my students and I have built up over the years. It's a compartmental model. That is, the circulatory system is a continuum, as I showed you on an earlier slide, but we break it into pieces. The pulmonary capillaries, the pulmonary veins, aorta, main arteries, systemic capillaries, etc., and assume that the blood flows sequentially from one compartment into the next and gets mixed in that compartment and then goes to the next. And by doing that, we can, instead of needing maybe a partial differential equation to model the transport through this loop, we can have a finite set of ordinary differential equations, one for each of these compartments. Another simplification, the blood is, as I indicated earlier, it transports both oxygen and carbon dioxide, but we consider only carbon dioxide in our model, ignoring the oxygen concentration. And this is well justified by medical research, including this work done here in Toronto in Bradley's group. They did careful experiments that showed the oxygen concentration really seems to be irrelevant as far as chain strokes respiration is concerned. So that's a useful simplification for us. In the model, I will discuss or use three rate constants, and it's traditional in this literature to use over dots to indicate a rate constant. So these are not derivatives, these are constants. F dot is the blood flow rate as it's pumped by the heart. P dot is the rate of production of CO2 by your metabolism, the total amount for the whole body. R dot is the respiration rate of removal of carbon dioxide. And these are typical numbers. By the way, this works out rather nicely, 5 liters per minute. These are numbers for an adult male, a typical adult male. So it happens that the typical adult male also has 5 liters total volume of blood in the body. So if it flows at 5 liters per minute, that means your heart completely, you know, overturns the blood, makes one circuit through the system every minute, 5 liters per minute in sort of round figures. We use the standard conservation law for compartmental analysis that amount of carbon dioxide in a compartment is determined by the amount that comes in minus the amount that goes out. So the rate of change of the total amount, so that's the volume times the concentration in compartment J, the rate that changes is the flow rate times the difference of in minus out, plus or minus, in some cases, a source or sink that produces additional carbon dioxide or takes some away. So for the systemic capillaries, for example, the equation becomes this, where P dot is that rate constant I just showed you, the rate of production of carbon dioxide by metabolism in the body. In the lungs, the carbon dioxide is removed. This is a removal rate. The removal rate is proportional to the flow and the difference in partial pressures of CO2 across the pulmonary membrane that the CO2 crosses, and there are various other constants here that I need to go into detail. So the oxygen gets to the lungs, I mean the CO2 gets to the lungs, it has to then be expelled into the air, and that is determined by a number of things, but primarily by the ventilation rate, V dot, that is the rate at which you're breathing, so to expel the old air and bring in new air, and the difference in partial pressures. P is partial pressure of carbon dioxide. P9 is that in the lungs, or the alveoli of the lungs. And PI means inspired inhaled partial pressure. That is just the normal partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is a very low value, so that this is always positive. So this takes carbon dioxide out of the lungs. This brings it in across the pulmonary membrane from the blood. Yeah, here's the typical partial pressure for CO2 in the atmosphere. And this is volume of the lungs for an adult male. Okay. Now we need to control this system. It doesn't just run, like a zombie. It has to accommodate to changes in our activity levels and so on. So there's a feedback control system involving a low-level part of the brain. And we assume that the key to this control is the peripheral chemoreceptors, as they're called. They monitor CO2 concentration through the pH indirectly. And there's this nice paper that describes that in some detail, again by Toronto researchers who I guess are not represented here. The brain gets the signal from these chemoreceptors, and if CO2 is high, then it stimulates the breathing rate to increase, and similarly if it decreases, it says you can relax now, lungs, you take a break. Mackey and Glass were modeling this feedback control by a Hill function in the equation I just showed you, so you take the same approach here. So here's the Hill function, nonlinear response to the concentration. C5 is the concentration in the blood flowing to the brain, and this is the constant, which is normal because, of course, if A is the normal value of the arterial CO2 concentration, then when those two are equal, this is just becomes 1/2, which cancels that 2. So this bar indicates the mean or normal value of the ventilation rate. And mu, as I said earlier, represents the slope or gain of this nonlinear function at the equilibrium value. All right, putting all of that together, then we have this set of ODEs, which are mostly linear. They're really quite simple, ordinary differential equations, most of them just the basic conservation law. The complexity comes in the lungs here with the feedback control term here and so on. When you do this non-dimensionalization, this is something applied mathematicians like to do because you get rid of a lot of parameters. And in addition, you come up with ratios which often have an intrinsic importance of their own. And in this case, there are two of these critical ratios. The ventilation perfusion ratio, right? This is the ventilation, the lung ventilation rate, and F, the flow rate in the blood, is also called perfusion in the literature. Or this ratio of the production of carbon dioxide by metabolism divided by the blood flow rate. And that's a cardiovascular efficiency ratio. The more you can sort of get rid of the carbon dioxide for a given flow rate, the more efficient your cardiovascular system is. And if you look back here, you see M appears in this equation, and that's the cardiovascular efficiency, and here's the ventilation perfusion ratio. I use that phrase because that's quite standard in the medical literature. The respiration people talk about ventilation perfusion ratio a lot. They're aware of the importance of that ratio. And it comes up quite naturally in this system. Here are all the sort of physical parameters that we've used. So I want to emphasize here that this is not a modeling approach where you write down a bunch of equations with lots of coefficients, which you then fit using statistical analysis to get, to match the output that you want. We've not done that at all. We've made these physical assumptions about the behavior of the system. We have physical parameters here, like the volumes of the various compartments and amount of blood and concentrations. These are all taken from, this is just copied out of our paper, from these references in the medical literature. So we don't play with these constants. They're given, okay? Now we have the model, we analyze it. First, you find the steady state. That is, set all the derivatives equal to zero and solve the right-hand sides equal to zero and find the steady state. And fortunately, it came in pretty good agreement. I don't give the numbers here with steady respiration in an adult human male at rest. Linearize at the equilibrium and compute eigenvalues, the Jacobian matrix. Applied mathematicians do that all the time. And then not only compute the eigenvalues, but compute them as functions of the parameters to see if as you vary some of the parameters, you get a crossing pair of complex eigenvalues crossing the imaginary axis. That's of interest because that gives rise to a hot bifurcation, producing a periodic solution, and you study stability, etc. So, in particular, it's interesting to know how the hot bifurcation, which, assuming we find one, varies with the gain mu and the ventilation perfusion ratio. Why do I choose those two parameters? Well, one is the gain, for completely different reasons. Not much is known about the gain. It's known that this feedback control is quite sensitive, that a small change in carbon dioxide in the blood can produce a large change in your breathing rate. But I couldn't find solid values for this gain in the literature, and or even for the function. Right? I said Glass and Mackey pulled a Hill function out of the air, so I just followed their lead. But nobody knows, or at least I haven't been able to find, I need to talk to medical people, exactly how this feedback control gain is determined. So rather than arbitrarily fix a value, choose a range which seems to include reasonable values, and then just sweep through that entire range of values of mu and see what happens. Ventilation perfusion ratio, well, that's just the opposite. That is very well documented in the medical literature. But it's not a fixed number. It depends on what you're doing and your level of physical fitness and so on. There's quite a range of values. So again, it doesn't make sense to fix it, but to vary it and then see what happens. Okay? So, just for those who don't know the hot bifurcation theorem, I'll skip that since we're all mathematicians here. My standard model takes the parameter values from the table and varies the gain mu and the ventilation perfusion ratio R, and this is what we get. So I need to explain this graph to you. You see here on this axis is the gain, the values of mu, and as I said, the gain is quite high, so these are numbers fairly far from one. This ventilation perfusion ratio, at least at rest for a healthy person, is fairly close to one. So a normal person not undergoing CSR is sort of in this region where it says steady, and indeed for those values we find a steady state solution, no oscillation, the concentration settled down to constant equilibrium values. This blue line is the line along which a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues crosses the imaginary axis, so this is the hot bifurcation curve. Along this line, a hot bifurcation occurs. As you cross that line, the equilibrium steady state becomes unstable and is replaced by a stable oscillation. We interpret that oscillation as Chain-Stokes respiration. So above the line, Chain-Stokes respiration, below the line, constant behavior, no oscillation. Okay? So this is the result we get just with the choosing the parameters from the literature and then varying gain and this ratio. So normally you would be about here. Let me just give do a little digression that I don't have on the slides, but to show you what this tells us already. I said ventilation perfusion ratio can change under different conditions. Gain, I need to do more study. I don't know what might affect the gain, but I do know from the literature what can cause this ratio to increase. So supposing you're here around 10 in gain and you increase this ratio, you're going to cross from steady to oscillation, right? Well, it is well known. In fact, I've had people tell me they've had this experience themselves. If you're into mountain climbing, mountain climbers know that healthy adult mountain climbers tend to be very healthy, who do not have Chain-Stokes respiration at home, when they're up in the mountains for a few days, their friends tell them, especially at sleep, they go into very heavy Chain-Stokes respiration, and they never experience anywhere else but in the mountains. Well, what's going on? Obviously, in the mountains, the atmospheric pressure is low, including oxygen and carbon dioxide. All those partial pressures are lowered. And so I did a little reading, and it turns out that if you're a mountaineer, after a day or two in the mountains, your body acclimatizes to the thinner air at high altitudes, and without any conscious, willful decision, you start breathing more deeply, more heavily, to get the oxygen you need into your lungs, because the air is so much thinner. And again, after a day or two, the studies have shown, your heart rate goes back to normal. Initially, at high altitudes, your heart will beat heavier too to get the oxygen you need. But the accommodation that a normal, healthy human body makes at high altitude is to breathe more heavily, but heart rate goes back to normal. So the ventilation is up, and the perfusion or blood flow is not, so the ratio is up. And it typically can be double. I find a factor of two. If you're well up in the mountains, I forget the elevation required now, but so if you double this ratio and everything else stays the same, you could go from here to there, right? You move horizontally, you go from no CSR to CSR. So the model already is explaining or giving an explanation, possible explanation for. Sorry? Unfit people, well, you don't have to go so high. it can happen even at moderate altitude. And they make an adjustment, but if you have, I will talk about heart problems, circulatory problems. A less fit person might be on the edge of this already, and just many things could trigger, set them over the line. Or if you're very sick, I'll talk more about these problems, pathologies that are associated with. This slide just shows the actual oscillations at three points in the circulatory system, the blood leaving the lungs, in the arteries, approaching the brains, and then returning to lungs, and you see the staggered phase relationship that it gets delayed, as you would expect. And if you look down here, there's a time scale which you can't read, but it shows the period is in the right range. So we have some confirmation that the model reproduces the picture from the Guyton textbook, the classic medical textbook that I showed you earlier. So already we have period of oscillation is in the right range, the phase relationships are right, flow rates, concentrations, everything is in pretty good agreement with the medical literature. Okay, now suppose something goes wrong. You have people who are not so healthy, and or you change things in the body. And so let's see what happens when we perturb our standard model by varying parameters. One thing I read in the literature is that it's a known technique in sleep labs and so on. If people are experienced in CSR and maybe they're weak and this is not a good thing for them, you know, to go without breathing for intervals of time, you can suppress it. You can get rid of it by putting on a mask and giving them extra carbon dioxide. Inhaled carbon dioxide can make CSR disappear. So what happens in the model? Remember, the inhaled or inspired partial pressure CO2, P sub I, is one of our parameters. Increase it from less than 1 to 5. You can that's millimeters of mercury, so that's still very low, right? You can take it much higher. And you see the curve, this is the standard curve you saw before, it's now moved up to this one with the crosses on it. So the CSR region has gotten smaller. So if you were just over the line before and you do this, now you're back in the steady region and CSR disappears. So the model duplicates what the experimenters have learned. Now let's get to something more serious. Chronic heart failure, or congestive heart failure, either way it's CHF, is a serious problem, mainly in older people, where it's not a heart attack, you know, it's not a sudden thing, it's a gradual, slow weakening of the heart, where the heart muscles get weak and they stretch. It's called myocardial hypertrophy. They pump less blood, so it tends to pile up in various parts of the body, in the lungs, in the legs. So especially in the lungs, you get fluid buildup, which is pulmonary edema. All these things together, it's really a collection of phenomena together that are called go under the heading of chronic heart failure. People with this weakened heart condition often die of it. It's often the last straw for older, weaker people. And it's also very common for such people to exhibit chain-Stokes respiration. Just for, they spontaneously go into this chain-Stokes oscillation, whereas they had never had, you know, in their younger, healthier days. Furthermore, because they're already weakened, the combination of the two results in elevated mortality, as the medical papers put it. Bradley and Flores have documented that. So this is quite serious. I don't know if I have a time for another little anecdote. My youngest daughter is a occupational therapist who works in a sort of a chronic care hospital for the elderly, so she sees this a lot. And I was telling her about this work, not knowing she even had any idea. I just said, you know, I tried to explain about chain-Stokes respiration. She said, oh yeah, I know what that is. We have to watch our patients when they start chain-Stoking, we call the doctor in. So it's a verb in her vocabulary because they're, you know, often in this condition. When they start chain-Stoking, you're... Okay. So I thought that was fun. The left heart, because of the weakened muscles, can increase to tremendous size, according to Guyton. And I don't know why it wants to jump more than one. So we're here, eh? Yeah. So there are two things here that we can incorporate in the model: increasing the left heart volume as the heart gets weaker and it swells, and congestion in the lungs would effectively decrease the volume available to air in the lungs. So here we are. Let's try both of those. Suppose we're in congestive heart failure and the left heart blood volume increases. That was V2 in our model. So it goes from 0.15 to 0.2, 0.3. So I just double it. It could do more than double, but you see it, the curve moves downward as you increase the left heart volume, which means the area of oscillation is getting bigger. If you were near the boundary before, you're on the other side of it now. Similarly, if you decrease the volume available for gas in the lungs because it's getting congested, filling up with fluid, the same thing happens. Decreasing the volume increases CSR, or the other way around, I've written it there. So again, the two physical manifestations of congestive heart failure are enough to explain an increase in the prevalence of chain Stokes respiration without getting into any complicated medicine. Just simple physical things that a mathematician can understand. All right, let's move on to encephalitis. This is an inflammation of the brain caused by infection. It can damage the brain because, of course, the brain's trapped in the skull. You increase the pressure, that's serious. It can't just expand like your ankles would if they're inflamed. So it can be fatal. It also increases the likelihood of chain Stokes respiration. Well, why is that? We hypothesize that pressure creates resistance to the blood flow to the brain. There's back pressure, so the blood flow is reduced to the brain and therefore to the chemoreceptors, right? And the respiratory control center, it's called here. So we conjecture that that is the key, and the way we've tested that, we've modified the model to adding a new compartment around the chemoreceptors, which is diffusively coupled to the blood. It's no longer bathed in the flow that's going through the brain because the flow is slowed down so much, but it has to diffuse into the chemoreceptors. And as you do that, then the parameter you vary is the diffusive coupling constant, and as it gets smaller, this moves down, and I haven't labeled the two ratios, but remember below means steady state, above means chain Stokes oscillation. So as this moves downward, you get increased chance, increased likelihood of CSR, and smaller diffusion means it's harder for the blood to get to those chemoreceptors. Over here you see the oscillations of carbon dioxide in the blood and in the lungs. And so these are in different units, which is why the amplitude is so different here. But the interesting thing is the phase shift in this model. They're almost exactly 180 degrees out of phase, which for time delay people, you know, that's the worst possible time delay, right? And for instability in a differential delay system is if your oscillation is delayed by half a period. So it's not surprising that's so unstable. So one more quantity to look at. Remember, we had these two dimensionless ratios. wrong button. M is the ratio of the production of carbon dioxide by metabolism in the body, and F is the blood flow rate. And you would assume that a higher value of this ratio is a more efficient cardiovascular system. That is, an athlete has more red blood cells, can carry more CO2 out of the body when they're exercising without having to increase the actual flow rate, so the heart doesn't have to work as hard, and he can run longer and faster and so on. So this is high M is I interpret as an athlete. And now as you increase M, the curve moves downward again, which means a larger unstable area for chain strokes respiration. So here you have kind of a paradox. A more healthy individual, more athletic, has a higher likelihood of chain strokes respiration. Kind of counterintuitive, but this is what the model shows. I haven't been able to find literature to confirm or disprove this, but it's an interesting conjecture that comes out of the model, so I left that toward the end. I'd like to talk to maybe sports medicine people who might be able to shed some light on that prediction. Okay, so I'm essentially done. Just to summarize, the model provides possible mechanisms for onset of chain strokes relation, and that is, if you increase any of the following, the ventilation perfusion ratio, the feedback control gain, cardiovascular efficiency, left heart volume or lung congestion, increasing any of those, according to the model, should increase the chance of CSR, lead you into that unstable region where oscillations appear by hot bifurcation. The model further predicts, you know, more specifically, that at high altitude, it gives a good explanation for onset of CSR. Congestive heart failure, of course, as I said. Encephalitis. And surprisingly, the higher cardiovascular fitness or efficiency all predict CSR. There's still much that can be done. As I said, all of the parameters I've chosen and kept fixed in the model are typical of a male. Females typically have smaller blood volume, smaller lung volume, you know, a lot of the numbers are smaller for females. That's interesting because medically it's known that men are much more likely to have chain strokes respiration than women. Now, so my question is, can that be explained purely by these physical parameters? Is this just because women are on average are smaller that the physics then determines, moves that boundary so they're less likely to have it? I haven't done that yet, but that's a question. I'm looking for another student to redo this for females and see what the result is. Similarly, of course, infants have very different parameters. And it has been conjectured, I'm sure everyone has heard of sudden infant death syndrome, which basically infants in their cribs sleeping just stop breathing and don't start again. So you can't help thinking there may be a connection between that and sleep apnea, only in apnea you start again, right? So it's not fatal. And so the proposal is to consider parameter values for babies and see what the CSR model says and whether it can shed any light on sudden infant death syndrome. It's been conjectured. I've seen one or two papers in the literature that conjecture a connection, but no one has studied it. I mean, you can't conduct these experiments on a baby, right? But you can do anything you want on a model. It doesn't matter if the model dies. Better understanding of the feedback control gain mu, as I said, we just sweep it through the range because we don't know really what it should be. I would hope there's a possibility this model could be a predictive tool in clinical settings. So, and as my daughter said, this patient is chain stoking, then you can run your model and see what should be done about it. And, well, as it just says, not only for babies, but for adults. There's some experiments you can't do on humans, because it could be fatal, but that's not a restriction in a computer model. So thank you. That's the end of my talk. This is the paper, which I have copies of, if you'd like me to send you one, in PDF. Thank you very much for your attention. The Stokes of fluid dynamics? The Stoke?
Stroke.
Stroke. Oh, sorry. Okay. I haven't seen a strong connection between chain Stokes observation and stroke. The fact that, you know, after you stop breathing, oxygen goes down and CO2 goes up during that period, that if you're already weakened in a condition where you might be close to, you know, it could trigger something like that. But I'm not aware of any data that says strokes are very prevalent during chain strokes respiration. Yes? Sure, yes? Yes. Well, I agree that if you're older or weakened, or if you're vulnerable to those things, then this could be the final straw. CSR could trigger such a thing. But for normal, healthy adults, the risk is very small. And it may be that the mask that you talk about is mainly for obstructive sleep apnea. It increases the airway pressure to keep the airways open to prevent obstructive sleep apnea. And that may be more serious, you know, because it's an actual physical blockage that has to be cleared before you breathe again. That may... Yeah, I think this is the mask. This is obstructive sleep apnea. The mask, there is a mask, a CPAP. CPAP, yeah, is normal air at increased pressure, normal air, normally, it's normal air. And
talking about increasing CO2.
Yes, that's another... medical experiment. No, I suppose. See, with the increased CO2 kind of heightens the stimulus to these chemoreceptors to make you breathe. So that might work as well. The CPAP though is simply air at increased pressure, which is designed to open this physical obstruction. That is what blocks the breathing and causes what's called obstructive sleep apnea. And that is more common, especially among older, overweight men. Not people like you, of course. Yes? Anything else?
I'm just wondering whether you looked at any control mechanisms that are moving the other way, for example, like respiratory controls to cardiovascular adaptation to CO2 levels.
The other direction. So does respiration affect the... it does. Yeah. When the brain senses the carbon dioxide is away from what it should be, it triggers the respiratory system to breathe more or less to bring things back in balance. It also, of course, increases heart rate. You know, and I've ignored that. I've assumed, because during chain Stokes respiration, the fluctuations are in CO2 are small enough that the heart doesn't change. It does during obstructive, if it lasts long enough, obstructive apnea. But in chain Stokes, I've made the assumption that the heart rate, the blood flow rate, this F dot, is constant. But that's an idealization. There is some fluctuation there as well. And I've ignored that. At the back, sorry. It's very close. That there's a fairly wide range in the literature, you know, for different sized people and so on, but it's less than a minute, you know, half a minute to a minute, it's in that range for CS. Sorry, me?
What is half a minute to a minute?
The whole period, yeah. One apnea and one hyperpnea, to return to where you started. You'll start anywhere in the cycle and return to that. So from maximum to minimum, back to maximum, is about a minute, typically a little less than a minute, 45 to 50 seconds. And in our numerical model, just compute the solution and look at it, and the period is in that range, half a minute to a minute.
One
complete oscillation, yes.
Yes,
yeah. Well, go back to this one. Way back. This one, I guess. No, the next one. Well, this is scanned out of a medical textbook, so you can't expect numbers. this is just drawn by hand. It's not actual science. But if you look in the word, in the text itself, one period, which is, if you like, from there to there or there to there, there's more than a period there, is, as I said, half a minute to a minute. It's in that range. It varies from individual to individual. And even can vary somewhat in the same individual. Does that answer your question? Okay. The top one represents your actual breathing, up, down, inhale, exhale. And then the straight line is no breathing, apnea. Hyperpnea, apnea. Okay? So it's an artist's representation of what is observed as someone breathes and stops and breathes and stops. And then the lower one is based on actual measurements of carbon dioxide partial pressure in the blood at various points in the circulatory system, which can be measured with probes, etc. Yes?
So the parameters that you have just from all these references,
mm-hmm.
for male, those are for male breathing, not at rest.
They're, at rest, yeah, not exerting themselves, but not necessarily.
Are they very different if they're sleeping?
That's a good question. I don't think, the blood flow slows down even more when you're asleep, the F dot, and your breathing slows down. These are typical values taken from the literature for an adult male who is, say, sitting and reading as opposed to sound asleep or walking or running.
And also, you talked about the tidal volume that you use the function, the Hill function that Matthew Glass used.
Yeah.
But actually, very, very recently, I came across a paper where they actually model it using the first order, linear differential equation.
Yeah.
Kind of periodic, the input is just the air coming in. And it's a paper actually that's based from the late 70s,
It's also Glass and Mackey, did you say?
No, it's people in the...
Yes, the same in the department. What year did you say?
Hmm?
What year?
Late 70s or early 80s.
Well, that's about the time they arrived at McGill, late 70s.
Yeah.
Or mid-70s, I guess.
They have paper
so they were there then. Yeah. Okay, I'd like to see that, sure. There are lots of models. I'm not saying this is by any means the first time anyone has tried to model chain strokes respiration. There are lots out there, and I think that this is...
The mountain climber.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah, so when they're adapting to the decreased amount of oxygen.
Yes.
I guess, is there a way to see with your model why bifurcation?
Well, of course, I can't model oxygen directly because we excluded oxygen from our model. But reading the medical literature, we learned that the effect of low oxygen in the thin air in the mountains, after a day or two, it's a very slow response, as opposed to this, which is, you know, with less than a minute to respond. The PCO2 response is very fast. Your body responds to oxygen very slowly, which is why we can ignore it for this phenomenon. But it does respond, and studies on mountain climbers have shown that the essential response, there's probably more to it than this, but the part that an amateur can understand is the breathing rate goes up and can typically double. The ventilation rate, the amount of air you inhale, exhale from your lungs to get the oxygen you need. So for our model, the effect is the ventilation perfusion ratio has doubled because the heart rate stays the same. That's as far, I think, as I can go in the model. And then that means going across to the right, which would mean crossing the Hopf curve if you're high enough in gain. I can add to that, you may be interested, there's a book on high altitude medicine by a guy named West, which I looked up while I was considering just this question. And he apparently got data on Sherpas in the Himalayas, who've been there for many generations. And not only is their normal breathing rate higher than people, lowlanders who live near sea level, but they've adapted evolutionary or somehow to reduce the gain. It's one place where this feedback gain has been measured, and their typical feedback gain is much lower. That so that if I had this curve here, you would see that way. If you go off to the right, you're still safe. You're not less likely to curve that Hopf bifurcation curve. So I thought that was a very interesting adaptation. I'm not sure I answered your question, though. Yeah, I think with my model, this is about all we can do. But I think, it gives a good rationale. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes. Yes, that's true.